Welcome to the Art Grind Podcast. This is a podcast run by artists for artists where we talk about what it means to be one. I'm Tun Mian, the producer, with our host Dina Brodsky and Marshall Jones. This is being recorded between our many jobs and side hustles. We bring you in-depth investigations into the lives of artists we admire and the stories behind the creative journey. So stay on the grind while we fill your mind.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Art Grind Podcast. I'm host Marshall Jones, here with co-host Dina Brodsky. And today we are interviewing a really, really amazing painter, someone that I have not met before, neither has Dina, but we saw their work online and were really smitten by it. And we're lucky enough that he agreed to come on. Mark Dunford, all the way from the UK. Mark, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thanks. And thank you so much for asking me to talk to you.
Thank you so much for coming on. And I mean it. I think your work is absolutely gorgeous. Just the sense of symmetry and the shape and the color you use, it's so vibrant. Have you always been an artist ever since you were a kid, or how did you come
I mean, I can't remember doing anything else, to be honest. I didn't have any siblings, so I think I had to kind of preoccupy myself. So I think drawing and looking at things and really examining, I think I'm aware that, you know, a lot goes in through our senses, but especially the eyes. And I think the idea of looking at things intensely has always been something that fascinates me, in the way that I've been always interested in nature. So I think it was the woodcuts of Thomas Bewick and other people who observe nature that really got me into art. So that was the way in for me, really, which was kind of, and I obviously love watching people too. So looking at the way something might have a certain characteristic, you know, if you're painting something which is individual, it is totally individual. And there's lots of them. I suppose if you think about an apple since the Garden of Eden, and you look at an apple all the way through the history of art, the apple hasn't intrinsically changed, but the way people and the ideas they've used to make the apple changes that appearance of that apple. So although I look at things, you know, there's obviously ideas going on too. So yeah, for me, painting was very exciting, and it still is. And it gets more and more exciting. That's what's strange about it. Mm-hmm. You know, you go in the studio, you're there all day, and you realize that the day is suddenly evaporated. And what's amazing is you may have nothing to show for it, but at least you've kind of been through the kind of process of looking, and it's quite an intense experience.
Huh. Why do you think it does get more interesting as you get older, as you keep doing it?
I think it gets more difficult because I think you try and do more. And I think also, you know, you end up, I suppose, painting more and more through not knowing anything. So I think the more you kind of know, probably the less you know, in as much as you're trying to find a way to keep kind of keeping the thing alive. I mean, painting from observation, the very act of painting something that you can see and the challenges of that, and as one gets older, it's also not just a cognitive mental thing. It's also physically demanding. But I think it just grows. The possibilities just grow and grow and grow. And of course, one just obviously, there was someone who went to one of my first exhibitions in London, and in the visitor's book wrote anonymously. I've now since found out that it was Hippocrates who wrote it. But of course, it's that famous quote that art is long and life is short. And that has kind of, I was quite angry when I was about 25. Reading that. But incidentally, I'm less angry now, which is quite interesting. And just recently going to the big Freud survey exhibition at the National Gallery in London, just before Christmas in December, what was written on the wall, that very same quote.
Oh, really?
So I think that notion of time and that notion of, you know, because it does mark time, you know, if you're painting something that may not be there tomorrow, whether that be a flower or whether it be the transitory quality of light or the fact that things are so ephemeral. There's a kind of obviously a need to get a move on. But of course, painting is very, very, by its very nature, kind of systematic and very kind of slow. I do have speedy moments where I kind of look back and think, did I ever do that? You know, it happens so quickly. But then there's times when I really have to be in tune with what I'm trying to see. So I'm trying to look at the same pace at which I'm making the marks or trying to get my thoughts. Because I suppose if you're painting from what you can see, you can't paint the thing until you've seen it. And what is also interesting, and I think it was Patrick George who said to me, who was taught at the Slade when I went there, he says that you don't know what you're painting or drawing until you've drawn or painted it. The very act of going through it. And I think that's the mystery of it, because the mystery of the thing changes. And as you paint, it's not about the painting, it's also about the painter's perception of the thing that's being painted. So that changes and develops as the thing is being made. And of course, well, the idea is a lot of it's, well, probably I haven't worked out how much is, but of course, it's all about memory. So even though you're looking at something, you're still looking and then holding that thought in your mind, whether it's a thought, I don't know, a sensation, whatever you want to call it. You can't actually look at your painting and the thing simultaneously at the same time. So you're looking and you're holding. And obviously, the bigger the painting, the more difficult that becomes. So, you know, if you're like Freud and you're painting a large portrait, you look at the sitter and then you have to climb a ladder to put the brushstroke down. So the idea that you're holding this thing in your head, which is, I think, fascinating. But that, you know, the idea is that it, although it's out there, a lot of it is within. And I suppose, you know, if you close your eyes, can you actually remember it? What do you remember? And what is it that's so essential about the thing? Because it's very easy to go off on a tangent, probably like I've just done. But it is very easy when you're painting something to go off and, I suppose, end up painting another painting on top of the painting that you started. So the idea and what you're trying to actually say or paint about or investigate or research, I think that's, you know, I've just spent, I suppose, quite a long time, because I make my own frames, and the idea is that I do that for certain reasons, namely because I don't want anything to impede the rectangle. But of course, you realize when, once you frame something, that the search and the journey is ended. Mm-hmm. That's quite sad, really.
It's over, yeah. Uh-huh.
Do you think?
Do
you think it's? Do you remember the first? Okay, I don't think I've read my Bible in a very long time, but the very first part of the Bible where, you know, the God naming, you know, naming the animals, naming the, you know, the mountains and the sea, et cetera. Painting something is almost like, it's like giving it a name. It doesn't quite exist until you look at it for long enough and almost like name it, capture it and paint, right? And then it becomes like, does it become more real via the attention that you give it?
I think that's very interesting. I think the idea is that when you're painting perceptually, it still amazes me that I'm looking at something. The signals are coming into me and then they're coming out of me, which is they're being translated onto a surface. Obviously, ostensibly, what I'm looking at is three-dimensional and what I'm making is two-dimensional. But of course, what you've just said, Gina, is interesting, because I try and unname things. So the idea is I'm really resisting. I'm taking things apart. I'm deconstructing them. So I'm not taking apart an apple. I'm taking it apart in terms of its relationships or its power or energy in a different way. So I'm not seeing it as it. I'm seeing it as part of the the shelf it might be sitting on, or I'm seeing the apple on the wall as being equal. So the whole thing has no name. And I think what's ultimately really important when you're trying to paint something from what you can see is to try and get rid of those labels. And often, in order to do something, you really do have to prevent yourself from trying to do it. Yeah. If that makes any sense at all.
I like that. So if the animals and the mountains only became themselves after they were named, kind of that, what you're saying, unnaming it maybe brings it back to whatever it was, the universal unknown, is something bigger than itself, something bigger than just the apple.
Well, it's, I suppose, the idea that it changes once it's been painted. And what I'm trying to do is to paint about the apple. I'm not trying to paint the apple. I'm not trying to copy it. I'm trying to paint something about what I'm thinking or seeing or feeling. But of course, that's a lovely premise to start. But of course, the painting takes you away and it evolves. And slowly, you don't quite know. Sometimes you've got absolutely no idea where you're going to end up, because it's an experience. The whole notion of sitting there trying to mix a value and make those values add up into something. I don't have any kind of formula as such. I do repeat certain ways of working, but I try very hard to treat every painting as a new start, as a new experience. Although I may have painted every year when the red apples come on the tree, I obviously want to try and paint them. But I don't remember the previous paintings. This is a new experience, a bit like meeting a new person, a new thing. Although it has a name of apple, it's a new apple, a new thing, a new person.
Sort of like you can't step in the same river twice, like each time a brand new experience.
It's now, isn't it? It's about what's happening now at that moment. Although my paintings accrue, and the idea that they are layered and they build, it's very much about what am I seeing at this moment? What am I feeling at this moment? How can I respond to that? So I don't have any formula. I don't say I now have to do this, or I have to kind of put in an underglaze, or they are abstract things. The paintings are abstract. The thing I'm looking at is abstract. Although I'm looking at things that I know what they're called, it is an abstract experience.
And it's mediated, like you were talking about, because you paint primarily, maybe exclusively, from life, right?
All from drawings.
All from drawings. So explain
quite
that.
Quite rarely.
Okay.
So, the drawings I've obviously made.
Right. And then you color them through imagination?
Or memory.
Wow.
So there's a painting that went on for about, went on for about 10 years, I think, but that's probably nothing to do with the fact that I needed 10 years. It's just the way it will. Worked out. I was living in London, and like we were coming to Cornwall quite regularly. And so every summer I'd make this drawing, and then I would take the drawing back with information and then try in London to paint the painting. I think the painting was sort of over five feet wide, quite a big thing. So, the pieces of paint and the shapes became quite large things. They became quite physical. And it's quite good to change the scale that one works, because you can get stuck in a scale, I think. So it's quite useful to change that, because we don't really know what size we see things. We've got, we know that it's just an electrical thing on the back of our eye, as the object disappears in the cone of vision to the dot or to the signal. Where we intersect that cone is obviously to do with the idea of what we're trying to paint about. So this painting went on and on, and then obviously I would run out of information in London and I had to go back to Cornwall, and then that would inform what I would draw about when I went back to, and then I would bring it back again and then try and exhaust it. But there were no colour notes, there were no photographs, absolutely no reference in terms of the key of the colour or the saturation. It was purely about the remembered experience of being rooted to that spot at that moment in time. Wow. But of course, the painting became its own thing, you know, and I think that's what painting should become. They, whether you're working abstractly or working from something, they have to stand up in the world on their own. They have to, you know, they have to go away and be where they are without me, you know. That's
Let's backtrack for a sec. So how did you go from being the kid without siblings who draws all the time to being, you know, Mark Dunford, the person who makes paintings live on their own? I feel like there's a few steps in between. Like when, you know, when did you, I mean, you went to art school, so you must have, you know, when did you set a direction?
Well, I've always wanted to do it, I think. Never really knowing what it was I wanted to do, but I've always thought that I'm interested in this. This consumes my time and I enjoy doing it. So I suppose I remember moments when I was very young, probably about, I don't know, 6 or 7, when people suddenly got interested. You know, the teacher would say, "Oh, look at this, and you must come and see the head teacher and show this drawing." And there was a big kind of hoo-ha about this drawing, and I just went along with it, and I go, "Oh, okay, that's interesting." And then I suppose you meet people along the way. So there was an art teacher I had when I was making the transition. We have a school called a middle school and a secondary school. I don't know what the system is in the US, but I remember there was an intervention, because basically you didn't choose where you went, and this art teacher intervened and said, "No, this boy needs to go here because the art's good and the drama's good." So that was it. I went, and I just went along with it, I suppose, and just thought that's, you know, I was fascinated by what she was doing, fascinated by the way she could paint things, which she did a lot, she demonstrated. So I think it's meeting people along the way. So then I just carried on, and I've had a wonderful re-meeting after 40 years with my secondary school art teacher, who I hadn't seen since I was 16. And it was absolutely wonderful. He got in touch and said, "I'd like to come and look at your pictures." And I remember him being, you know, a force, and I remember him, you know, really helping me. And I think helping me in terms of realizing that I could achieve things. You know, as a young person, you do your thing and you try and do it as well you can. But I think it's good to have these people who help you on your way. And then I suppose I just realized that at the age of 16, I might go to art school. So I went and did a foundation course. So this was a 2-year foundation course. And it so happened that it was a very good one. And it was in Dorset, at Bournemouth. And there were some wonderful people who taught there, people who I remained in touch with. I remained in touch with their families ever since. But the link, I suppose, is that probably, I suppose, a third of them all went to the Slade School. So one, my tutor just said, "Oh, I think you quite like the Slade." So I went to the Slade. And I remember the foundation course being very instrumental. It was very serious. It's probably very, kind of had a sort of few sort of Black Mountain principles to it. We would study colour for a whole day every week for 2 years. We would do life drawing for a whole day for 2 years. We would work in the studio making paintings. We would do experimental image making. We would make sculptures, we would take photographs, make film. So it was an incredible thing. And it kind of happened on this kind of, in this clifftop house. And it was an amazing building. It's not there now, used for something else. But the poet Shelley, his parents lived in this house. And it was an amazing, amazing, you probably know that Bournemouth's quite famous for its Victorian writers. I think Robert Louis Stevenson wrote Jekyll and Hyde there. And you know, there's a wonderful kind of feeling about the place. It's very new, really. It's a Victorian spa town. But there was this building on the edge overlooking the sea, and it visually was exciting. And visually it was also very, very ordinary. There was a bowling green, and it was very laid out. It was very sedate. And anyway, and the idea was there were some wonderful people who taught there, and they pushed you and they encouraged you, and they're absolutely responsible, I suppose, for changing one's life, which is probably why I teach so much. I like the idea of helping others, because I recognize that I've been helped a lot myself. So I went to the slave. Sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. It was the time where Uglow was teaching, right?
Yes, no, I went to the Slade in 82. And Uglow was there. Patrick George and Ewan ran the Life Studios, which were these kind of studios at the top of the Slade at that point. From memory, I think there were five main studios. So it was a very popular thing. There was about eight people in each studio around a model. They were called the F studios. And I think there was a bit of, Patrick had a bit of fun about it, because I think the F stood for figurative. But in fact, the F, I think, was a remnant on a door which was left when there were science labs. So I don't think the F had anything to do with it. But they had wonderful light, wonderful light. There was north facing with high windows. And on the other side of the corridor, there was a round room, which had a beautiful vaulted round skylight. And it was extremely beautiful, and it was very serious. It was very intense. It didn't suit everybody. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And I think, you know, there are probably times there when, you know, as a young person, you're not quite sure what's going on. This is quite extreme. You had undergraduates mixed in with postgraduates. So you had people who've been there for 6 years, you know, extraordinarily intense, knowing what they wanted, you know, having a great command and a kind of visual recall of the history of painting and the history of art, including all sorts of things about sculpture and printmaking. And, you know, it was incredible. It was very serious. There was no talking, absolutely. When the model was posing, the model was the most important thing in the whole space. And it was intense. As I say, that didn't suit everybody. And I suppose the idea is that, you know, there were paintings that I painted there that I knew I was lost. But I suppose you have to get lost a bit. And I think I was lost a lot. But, you know, I think, I mean, Ewan came in every Friday and was very respectful of people's time and would just come in the morning and very early. And I like to get there very early. I think I used to get there about, I seem to have a memory, I used to get there about 7:30 or something in the morning. And the model would come about 9:30, I think. Hmm. And we'd be painting all day, right through till the light went about 4:30. Sometimes in the winter, it was a bit, I mean, London was wonderful to be in London near the British Museum and near the National Gallery. Just being able to nip next door to the Courtauld Institute when it was very close, and we all had free passes to go and look at the Wall of Cezanne's or the wonderful Monet or the Bernardo Daddy, or, you know, incredible things. So yeah, I mean, those studios are very serious. I mean, I met people there who I'm still in touch with now, including my own wife, which was. No, and so we're both, you know, it's a bit of a house of painting really here, but
so she
was a very intense time. I'm sorry.
So your wife paints as well?
Oh yeah, no, she's very, very good.
Wow.
Very good. Very That's good.
Great. What's her name?
She's called Kay Vinson.
Kay Vinson. Well, I'll have to look her up.
She's very good. So Ewan would come generally at the end of the day, and we'd have a look at the pictures together, and then he'd probably say, "Let's go and get some wine," and there'd be lots of wine purchased, and we would do things like use the materials room where you stretch your canvases and make your gesso and things, and he would teach us how to cook and clean calamaris, and we would have this kind of civilized evening or end to the week.
Wow, that's great.
Which was great, you know. Or he might bring some. I remember him having something under his arm once and just said, "Here you are, hold on to this." And it was a Rodin bronze.
Oh.
You know, or he'd bring in postcards or photographs or books on things and lend you books. I remember he kindly lent me his very early facsimile of Piero della Francesca's Prospettive Pagendi, which was beautiful, beautiful book. And Patrick was there three days a week. And Patrick was incredibly patient. I don't know whether Patrick George is a landscape painter and makes wonderful portraits. There was a recent exhibition of portraits at Browse and Derby in London. An amazing exhibition. But he was incredibly generous with his time and very understanding. You know, when you're 18 and somebody of that caliber, somebody with that experience, somebody with that incredible knowledge would sit down with you for over an hour and a half or 2 hours and just one-to-one talk you through what you're trying to do. Absolutely, for an 18-year-old, it was incredible, but he still had that wonderful patience, and he did it with good humour, kept you going, you sort of, and things are, what's wonderful about it is they're still talking, you know, what's amazing about it. And there were visitors, lots of visiting artists, but, you know, people like Craig Yeatison, I think somebody got Auerbach in once.
Oh, wow.
There was a whole range of people, but also wonderful tutors. And the Slade was, you know, a great hub of all sorts of activity, you know, from people like Tess Jarret, the abstract, I don't want to say abstract painter, but Tess Jarret, wonderful painter, Bruce McLean, wonderful painter Jeffrey Camp, you know, sculptors, filmmakers, and lots of visiting people, and Lawrence Gowing. Lawrence Gowing was there, who at the time was writing a very wonderful Thames and Hudson monograph on Lucian Freud, and was very generous about talking about that and getting the students copies. And he was a wonderful force. And to hear him talk was amazing. His writing is fantastic. His book on Matisse and his essay on the logic of organized sensations about Cézanne is just incredible. I think he wrote it for the late Cézanne exhibition in the early 80s that was in Paris. And I think it went to Washington, I'm not quite sure. But then he became actually, when he retired from the Slade, he became, he worked in Washington for a bit, as I'm not quite sure where, but it was it was a wonderful place, a wonderful, wonderful. And of course you met, and the interchange of ideas. And although, you know, we were all trying to preoccupy ourselves with trying to look at things intensely, trying to make responses, trying to make sense of it whilst making sense of ourselves, making sense of each other, making sense of where we were, you know, it was a very heady time, really. It was fantastic. I don't think the studios are there now. But I suppose the idea is it takes someone else to go along and say, well, that's what I want to do. And then it might happen again. You know, there's no point holding on to something if it isn't wanted or needed, I suppose.
Well, it's a place I've always been fascinated with, because from like Coldstream and Uglow and I've heard that Freud would sort of be around the slate a little bit, and just I really love those painters in the history of the Slade school. What do you think differentiates a British painter from an American painter? Oftentimes you can sort of tell in terms of palette and stuff, where someone's coming from. What do you think the differences are?
I think the big difference is light. That's really significant. I often think, oh, wouldn't it be marvelous to have wonderful shadows?
Because of the clouds sort of keep everything even in England.
Well, there are a great number of days when the lid is on. And that's it, you know. But what I want to, that has its own beauty, of course. Mm-hmm. You know, that means the colour sings. And, you know, when it does get sunny here, I'm not quite sure I know how to cope with it. out comes the visor, you know, out comes the hats and not being able to, it's a challenge, you know. And I think sometimes, there's that constant grey, light is wonderful. But I do like painting sunlight. I'm not really sure I'm painting light at all, really. I suppose I'm painting colour. Hmm. But I think that for me, and I was thinking about this the other day, I don't know who I was looking at. Oh, I think the next exhibition that's in London next month, has got Ed Praby in it, I think. And Joe Murzich. And I think there's other, like Jennifer Paczynski. So this is the catalogue that the gallery have produced. And I'm just looking at the difference of light in those paintings. And, you know, and people like Zoe Frank, and, you know, you just get that kind of, there's an intensity, and you imagine that, you know, because when you're trying to paint something, you do have to hold your breath a bit, you know, in order to hold that memory and hold that position and hold the notion of that, what you're going to do about what you've just seen and what you're going to do about what you just understood or not understood in any shape or form. You have to hold your breath, you know, and I think probably you might have to hold your breath less, or you might have to hold your breath more. I don't know, but that's the kind of idea. And I can't make generalizations. Obviously there are lots of American painters who I admire a lot, and lots of abstract painters as well. You know, I can't make generalizations about how people might, you know, fit into a certain way of painting. It's hard enough just trying to look at things myself, to be honest.
Well, you talked about holding your breath, and it sort of reminded me, you more than most, because you kind of blew my mind that you draw these from life and then paint from your memory. And it's gotten me thinking about memory. Like, I was trying to just draw simple shapes from memory for a few months ago for an exercise. I was trying one a day, and I would basically look at a shape, try to remember it. This was a shape in a book or on a photograph or something. And then turn the page over on tracing paper, try to draw that shape, and then put it on top and see how close I got. And I was shocked at how bad I was at doing this. In that you are building these beautiful paintings off a sense of memory, I can't help but think that could be one of the things that struck me about your work, because some people will say, you know, your reactions in life are a total of your lived experience. Your memories sort of will influence how you react to different things in the future or in real time. And I wonder, do you think that's a way to get more of yourself into the paintings? Like, you're the filter, like you saw something, and then there is a blank slate that you start, that you're the translation device more than anything.
Well, I can't be conscious of that. You know, whatever gets in there, I just can't. I don't know. I suppose I have no idea. I don't know what it is about me that makes it what it is. And one's always trying to escape oneself, I suppose, as well. So, you know, the idea actually. But I think what I do need to say is that most of the paintings are painted from the thing in front of me. But what I meant was, you know, the idea that it's all a series of remembered glimpses. So it's thousands of, you know, you don't see the whole thing is in one go, although unity is a really, really important, I suppose, thing I'm trying to make, a unified, but I can't because I've got to make it in bits. So there's paintings that are painted from drawings that I can't sit in front of for a long time. Mm-hmm. That drawing painting, which I described, it just happened that the motif was taken away from me and I couldn't have made the big painting in the field itself. The other drawing, the painting that I've made, is of a double rainbow. So there was this fleeting double rainbow near the coast, and it was late evening, and of course everything was low. And I just tried to make this painting from this tiny drawing. And it was, you know, tiny. We're only talking about 6 inches by 4 inches drawing, which was probably made only in about a minute. But there was enough information and enough power in it and in my mind and my memory to actually then try and make something of it in paint. I made it slightly larger because that was the maneuverability. But it went on and on, that painting, a long time. It went through a whole range of versions of what a rainbow is. And what was interesting is, you know, from everything being there, almost, I mean, how do you make pigment look like light? I mean, how do you do that? I don't understand that. And, you know, I'm trying really hard to make that do that. And I suppose I ought to qualify that I'm trying to make it the colour of light, I suppose. That's important. But in the end, the rainbow almost vanished. It almost disappeared, almost to the point that I realised that it actually wasn't about the rainbow at all. It was actually about what the light did to the landscape around the rainbow. And in many ways, the rainbow was only a residue of that memory and of its existence. So the idea is that the actual rainbow became incredibly...
Oh, wow, yeah.
But what became really important was the idea that it was about how the light just incredibly changed this entire atmosphere outside. You know, when it's really incredibly bright down here and there's no cloud, you'd imagine that there's infinity. You know, it always feels quite vulnerable. You know, I quite like the idea that the lid is on, and I quite like the fact that I can feel the ground. But when you've got this notion that it goes on forever, and you really do get that sense of that here, you know, because you can't see anything else around, you know, you're looking, you know, Cornwall, I think it's about 8 miles across at its widest point, you know, so the idea is that you can see both coasts if you go up to a high vantage point, and then beyond that, you can't see beyond the horizon, you know. So just to say that most of the things are in front of me, but I suppose what I'm trying to say is that they're all built up of little bits of memory.
So a lot of people have different standards for, like, when, what they're going for in, for instance, painting a still life. Like, they might be saying, I want to get that color just right, you know, or whatever. And it feels like you're, if I'm understanding correctly, you're looking more for an internal accuracy, like a feeling out of what you're doing. There's some different barometer that isn't just copying, right?
Absolutely. I think there's obviously, you might start off with a series of relationships, but for it to work within the painting, you've got to make those adjustments. So you've got to push something that way or push something that way, either chromatically or tonally. You know, the idea of just you won't get anything unless you try and actually move things around. And of course, what's also fascinating is that the flatter you make something, the more spatial it becomes. So the idea is that, you know, what's really important is the fact that this is a flat surface, and you have to honor that, because if you don't, you end up with, I suppose, something that has not the control or the tension of the picture plane, but also of the surface through which you're almost like the veil that you're seeing through, but keeping everything as intact as possible. And I suppose that's what I'm, you know, trying to make it, it is a flat thing, and I'm trying to honor that. So that's why I like to think about the geometry, and I like to think about the placement of things. So things trigger an energy, there's a vitality to it. So that the idea is that, you know, everything has a power, or is almost seen like a force of one element. I won't hitting another element. But there's the kind of force of things. It's about having an idea about it, because we know that, you know, obviously color really is a non-physical entity. It doesn't exist really. It's here.
In our
totally
mind.
Totally here. And the idea is that the tangible things, like the drawing, for me, you know, I tend to find the color through drawing. Just, you know, so I, if I, the more I can draw something, and I, you know, I don't know what drawing is, you know, for goodness sake, Marshall, I have no idea, you know, I have no idea what it is. And it's, you know, so hard, and it is hard. And I suppose that's why we're trying to do it the whole time, because we're trying to get nearer it, or trying to, it's just really difficult. But the point being is that the color can be so many things, and you end up chasing your tail. You know, so if you haven't got a kind of idea about the color, whether it's to do with about the luminosity of something or the darkness of something or the way something is magical. But of course, you know, when you're painting something perceptually, often the very, very most beautiful, mysterious parts that you end up with are the bits you didn't notice when you were doing it. You know, it's those wonderful bits that slip between your ideas or slip between your decisions. And often you're making decisions about things that, you know, are, I suppose, just intensely ugly. It's that wonderful Seurat thing, you know. He said, they see art in what I do. All I do is apply my method. And I suppose that's all we can do, you know, as mere mortals. That's all we can do, is just say, I can do this and this and this, and hopefully something. But you never know, you're always surprised, because it's such an involving experience. You know, the ability to be objective when the whole thing, you know, is so overwhelmingly encompassing and absorbing, is very difficult. And the big conscious things about how the painting looks, or whether it's this or that, I've got no idea, absolutely no idea, until I suppose I let the paintings rest, and making the paintings rest. Because what's interesting is that my relationship with my paintings changed through time as well. You know, I don't understand them. I don't know what they are, what they look like. Sometimes I can't bear to look at them at all. You paint them and you think, you look at them out of one eye, look at them sideways, turn them upside down, look at them in a mirror. I've got no idea until maybe a year's time, maybe 2 years' time, maybe they always, and sometimes you might just see it on somebody's wall and you catch it out the corner of your eye and you go, yep, okay, there's something there. Still don't know what, but you know there's something there. So the whole thing is bewildering, to be honest.
So for you, kind of the pleasure of it or the meaning of it is applying your method and then, you know, applying your method and hoping the paintings take on their own life.
Well, there is that point, but the idea of trying to draw something and trying to find a value for something and to put it in a space and to put it on a flat surface with other things is just electrifying. It's the most beautiful thing, and it's so exciting. You know, pushing a piece of color around next to another piece of color. Wow, I mean, what could be more exciting than that?
So we, me and Marshall, have talked about this, and there's some painters that actually don't find it that exciting, and there's some, you know, what was it you were saying like a few weeks ago, Marshall, about like how people, you know, like they're either striving to achieve something, and then once they achieve it, they're instantly bored, and I was saying I never get to the bored phase, maybe because I never achieve it. I butchered what you were saying, but.
I think it's a Schopenhauer quote, a concept that you straddle the line between striving and boredom all the time. Like once you achieve, you're bored, and once you strive. So anyway,
most of it's hard work. You know, that's the point of it. So yes, I get excited. I'm not saying that excitement equates enjoyment. Most of it's about me shouting, I don't know, I don't know, I don't know. You know, that rings out through the studio window. You know, I really, and all I'm trying to do is to go to this thing each time, go to it and see what else I can see, what else I can find out, what else I can make. But, you know, that's what I'm doing now. I'm hoping that things will evolve. And I think things do evolve. I don't consciously, I do try and do things like, I suppose, pick another colour, a new colour that I've never used before, or try and do things differently. I try and set challenges for myself. But to be honest, the whole thing is so challenging anyway, because, yeah, it's... But yeah, I think it is exciting, but it is virtually probably an impossibility.
The way you talk about it is actually very motivating to me, because it's like it proves sort of a latent theory I have that, like, I can look at people's artwork, and if their artwork excites me, like yours does, they're on a search. And I guess what I was saying about different people's standards, like, imagine you're just copying a photograph in paint, you know, that's a thing, and that's interesting, but there's not a lot of search in that, because the answers are there, and the answers you could actually find should you want to, like, color match to the photo type thing, you know. And the painters that I find myself more and more responding to, like yourself, are ones who are searching out of curiosity, and the answers aren't there. So there's a question in here that is, it causes me, when I hear you talk like this, I get anxious, because you'll find relationships where there are no answers that work. They're like, that's beautiful. And then the painting has to move on because maybe it's not done. Do you find yourself working over those for the sake of other moments in the painting? Or how do you, are you like, I'll never get that back if I go over it? Do I defend a spot? How do you treat something like that?
No, I think I try not to preserve anything that I think is, I mean, I suppose the thing is, it's never there, or it never works until it almost expels me from it, to a point where I can do no more. And you don't often get to a point where it does that. But what I mean by that is, you know, I the whole surface is game. I'm happy to make adjustments. However, I'm very much aware that sometimes one's first responses are the responses that you should try and preserve a bit more. Because I suppose color values, and I mean the idea of trying to build on something you first placed down. You know, there's that wonderful piece of writing by Matisse where he just says, you know, the relationship of mixing color, and I won't get this right in any shape, shape or form, but you place them down, and if there's something working within that harmony, then you can proceed. If not, just take another canvas and actually start to rearrange them again. So what I'm trying to say is everything is in a state of flux. You know, I won't say, oh, that's a good bit, because I don't really know what that means. And I don't know what that is, because there's no such thing as bits, I suppose. The whole thing has to work together. So yeah, the things get wiped down, they get scraped out, and the whole thing is shifting forever, I suppose. But there are some constants and some things that remain. And I suppose it's to do with the idea of the drawing. It might be to do with the idea of the position of my eye and the position of the objects. However, you know, in a still life, I often introduce other elements halfway through the painting, or I take things out and I paint them physically out of the painting or paint them physically in. So until I understand, you know, or in order to understand something. So if I can make sense of something by introducing or removing another element, I will do that. You know, someone like Patrick George would go into the landscape, paint on a landscape for say 9 years or 8 years, through every season. And every time he would imagine that it's a white canvas. The whole thing is white. Whatever was there before, he'll just go there again. And if they start to settle, like where the tree trunks leave the earth, they might be the only constants, and that's it. But everything else moves around. However, if you look at them, they're so beautiful in the way that they are put together, the way that their color is so beautiful, the very thinness of the paint, you know. And if you compare that to someone like Auerbach, who will risk the whole thing and take the whole thing off, and, you know, he doesn't take the whole thing off because things remain. But it's that idea of re-seeing something, re-seeing it afresh, re-seeing it again and again and again. So, yeah, I mean, obviously what I'd like to do is to paint it only once, every bit once. I'd love that, you know. But, yeah. I mean, painting photographs is a funny idea, isn't it? I mean, but, you know, because it's 2D to 2D, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I love that challenge of that dynamic of space. You know, the idea of pushing a piece of paint, which might be in a landscape, say, a mile away from you, and bringing it up to another piece of paint that's right near your eye. So the idea of that notion of bringing it right there, although you know it's a mile away, or you know that that pot color is, you know, a meter behind that piece of color. So there's something beautiful about making that tension of space against the flatness of the surface. So yeah, I mean, I think Coldstreams is something that painting and photographs, there's no sport in it. So he wasn't interested in it at all. It's like shooting a sitting duck, I think he said.
And I brought it up because it is, the answers are there should you choose to, you know. It's like, it's a thing that's done that you can refer to. Whereas, I mean, I've seen people in drawing studios too, painting studios, put color swatches on actual objects so they know that they're getting that color just right. And an idea to me, to you, would almost seem absurd that you could take a piece of color in isolation and it work in the thing you're making, you know?
No, I find that very exciting.
That is exciting. Okay.
Because I think the idea of a local color is sometimes you need to do that. You need to kind of feel that reality, that contact with something. You know, obviously we know that we are painting the air between us and the thing that we're seeing. So there's that notion of space and air between it. But sometimes it's quite good to see the painting as a physical object in its plastic sense. The idea that it's not, you know, it's not about the kind of illusion, and you're not painting it off the eye, you know, because basically the paintings are an invention in many ways. Although they're perceived, they are flat. Right. They're an object. You know, you can look at the back of the painting, you can look at the side of the painting. It's not an illusionary window. So I'm not really interested in that idea. I'm more interested in making it in a more, I mean, I can't really put my finger on it, but the idea is that it is a very, very abstract activity. And I really want to respect and establish the picture plane and the color within its own right. Wow. Not necessarily in relation to the thing, because if you try and copy the colors that are there, it just ends up being awful. However, you use the word mediate, and I think that's an interesting word, because, you know, I think I'm not trying to force myself onto it. And I am trying to take back, because you've got this triangulation, haven't you? You've got the thing, you've got me, and you've got the painting. Mm. And as you go through the process, each part of each corner of the triangle informs the other. You never know which way it's going to inform you. But I think that is really important, you know, and I think that's something that one needs to be conscious of. So, you know, it starts to have a life of its own, but I can't paint it without the information.
I love the way you talk about this. Like, it's so inspiring to me. Could I ask you what you meant when you said plastic? Like, could you define that for me?
Well, I suppose it's the idea that I know I'm not painting the skin of the apple. I know I'm not painting water. You know, the water appears in that sense, but I know it's transparent. But the idea is that you could probably say a lot about a jug or a bottle with one shape, rather than putting everything you see in that bottle in terms of its subdivision or modulation or every highlight or every, you know, the idea that it is on its own as this plastic thing, in the same way that sculpture is, you know, the idea that sculpture is a physical force, you know, and what's wonderful about it. And again, it's memory again, isn't it? The idea that we can't understand a sculpture till we've walked around it, but we can't see it all in one go. So what we're doing is we're holding that view and then walking to the, and then we're holding that view and we're trying to piece it all together in our minds. So the notion that it becomes physical in our heads. So I think that's what I mean by plasticity, in terms of the idea of it living on its own, independent of what is there, although the what is there is so important and couldn't happen if it wasn't there.
So Mark, hold on, let's go back in your life a little bit. I actually want to get back to what you're talking about right now, but I also want to know how you became yourself. So you're at Slade, you're meeting all these amazing artists, and then what happens? And by the way, Americans, or at least like the part of the art world me and Marshall come from, I think really kind of glorify Slade. Like we, you know, it feels legendary. But what happens after you graduate?
Well, I started teaching before I even left the Slade. So I started teaching life drawing classes. I suppose I quite like learning teaching, but also learning more than I teach. And I quite like that interchange of teaching. So, you know, the idea is that I was encouraged to undertake scholarships. So we went to Madrid and we got a scholarship from the Royal Academy. I say we because my wife and I managed to go together. So there was wonderful opportunities in that the slave would often give you a bursary or a scholarship, which was wonderful because it allowed you to carry on a bit after. Because it's, you know, after that, I suppose, almost like a kind of intense existence of painting every day, perhaps from the same model in the same position on the same painting every day, all day for 12 weeks. That's quite an intense experience, you know. So leaving it was kind of a bit of a shock. I chose not to do postgraduate. I decided that, because I did 5 years at the Slade as an undergraduate. And then the idea is that I just decided that I would just try and see what I was doing outside of it. Because I think, you know, what the Slade did encourage you to do, it was to question. And it was a kind of, I suppose it's a research-based school, really. You know, that's what it's about. It's not it's not an academy of any kind. It's a research. It's quite radical. You know, we were forced to really empty the box out and, you know, try and repack it again every day, every hour. You know, there was no formulas of any kind. It was always a kind of the idea that you would take risks and learn by those risks. So the idea was that it's quite difficult to leave the Slade. And I think a lot of people found that quite hard. I mean, there was times when we laughed and times when we cried, you know. It was a whole range of human emotion, you know, and that's what's so wonderful about it. What was great is that people were, the tutors, Ewan and Patrick and everybody, were very keen that you continued to keep in contact. And they were very keen that you kept in contact with each other, and which, you know, I've tried to do to the best of my ability, try to actually remain in touch with these people who were, you know, they're significant in one's journey and one's development. I owe a lot to everyone around me. You know, that's what's, you don't do it in isolation, you know, and I don't do it in isolation now. So I started teaching and painting, and I've continued. So every moment I have when I'm not teaching, I paint. And the teaching kind of met some wonderful people teaching who I'm still in touch with. You know, I've been teaching for probably 35 years or something. And it's been wonderful. And I've enjoyed teaching, and I enjoy that exchange of ideas. And young people are wonderful, aren't they? Because, you know, they're so alive to it, and they're just so inspiring. And just the way they see things or understand things or gobble things up, you know, where they devour knowledge or experience. And although they, for me, watching that and seeing that happen is just wonderful and wonderfully exciting, and to see them realize that through their work and the idea of then helping them build their futures within, you know, not necessarily being a painter, but maybe being a graphic designer or working as a shoe designer for Nike or whatever it might be, being a set designer or working, you know, doing all sorts of things, sculptor, whatever they're doing, architects, you know, it's wonderful. It's absolutely so inspiring. So that's kind of continued. And then I became a member of the London group. So I was elected a member of the, and it's a wonderful organization. It was founded in 1913 by David Bomberg, Wyndham Lewis, and Jacob Epstein, Harold Gilman, and wonderful Camden Town painters, in response to the New English Art Club. It's still going now. It has a membership of about 90 members. It shows annually, but also has lots of other exhibitions. And obviously there's lots of smaller shows, and that's a wonderful community of artists, and they're incredibly diverse. So being part of them is fantastic, and being part of that group is a real honor, and something that I enjoy doing. And of course, you know, what's good about it is it promotes one's work and gives one a platform in which to show it. I probably showed a lot less than I do now. I'm show quite a bit now, but I suppose I didn't have anything to shout about or to show, really. I was more interested in trying to understand what I was trying to do, as I'm still trying to understand what I'm trying to do, to be honest. But you know, at the moment, you know, there's a gallery here in Cornwall called the Tregony Gallery, which is wonderful. They're inspiring couple, Judy and Brian Green, who run this amazing place, and they attract clients but also artists from all over the world, and they provide exhibitions. There's a show coming up in London, and that's been really fantastic. And what having a solo show for me, and it came very late, but it was a very exhausting but very, very wonderful experience in order to take stock of what I kind of thought I was doing, or maybe what I was doing, and producing a monograph, which was also a great, I suppose it's just, again, it's about learning. It's about being able to talk to someone. Dr. Elizabeth Reisner wrote the introduction, and she's a lecturer at the Courtauld. And just having, I think it was in lockdown, we had this wonderful, almost a 2-hour telephone call. And it was the most wonderful conversation. And of course, you know, Elizabeth then went and wrote the introduction, and she probably knows more about me than I do. It's very clear from looking and reading the book. So that's all. I'm here, and I, you know, and then, you know, we have family and children, and making them wanting to be interested in the world around them, which they both are. And I'm just trying to paint. It's quite simple, really, and trying to go and see things. It's a very humble experience, to be honest, and I'm very pleased about that, because I'm just trying to paint pictures that I believe in more and more and more, in this place, which I find inspiring, you know, and hopefully I'll be able to carry on doing it.
That was wonderful, by the way. And I, you know, for many reasons, but I think a lot of it is that you're doing this thing and the magic is still there for you. Like, you're not bored. You're not frustrated. You're just doing the thing that becomes more interesting rather than less, which I think is actually what happens if you, like, the more you know something, like, the more possibility that it has, not less, right? Okay, Marshall, I disagree with Schopenhauer. That's what I meant to say.
Well, I think it's exciting to me, because it feels like that's what's in your imagery is like, we've talked about it from a technical perspective, as well as kind of an emotional, like your engagement, your search shows up on the canvas and reaches me, you know, in New York, like, wow, this is really something, you know? And I think I kind of want listeners to hear these type of conversations, because it is who you are, and it is who you're interested in as much as the colors you're using, you know? Would you agree with that, Mark?
Well, as I say, I don't really know what is on the canvas. I really don't know, and I don't know how much of me is in it. All I know is it's me doing it. Color is important, but the color comes from the drawing, as I've said. But I don't know, was there, I'm sorry, Marshall, was there a question? I think I got distracted.
Yeah, no, not really.
We might have to edit that bit out.
But you did mention drawing as, and I wanted to understand what you meant by drawing. When you say you don't understand drawing and drawing is very difficult, are you saying, because different people talk about drawing in different ways, are you saying placement and scale as drawing, or are you talking about something maybe a little more esoteric like representation? What do you mean when you talk about drawing?
When you make a mark, or when you know, just the idea of making a mark, whether it be a line or whatever it might be, it's incredibly dynamic. It has an energy. And I suppose what I'm trying to say is when you then add color to that, you obviously then maybe the line disappears and it becomes about edges. But the idea is that I'm still trying to maintain the drawing for me is about placement. It is about putting things where I think I see them. And it isn't about putting them in the right place. Although I measure a lot, I might spend a long time trying to find the position of something. But of course, we know that, measuring really doesn't solve anything. It actually creates more problems than it solves. That's very clear because obviously we measure on the inside of an arc, and the idea is that we're trying to push that, to squash that onto a flat surface. So there's a whole manner of things that it throws up, which can be an idea in themselves, but it can also be problematic. And I suppose the idea is that everything is shifting because, it's a frustrating thing trying to say, is it here or here or here or here or here? And yet, but actually it could be quite happily being here and here and there and there and there all at once. So the idea that, you look at, and there's been a wonderful Cézanne exhibition at Tate Modern in London, which is still on now. And I've been visited twice. And, the idea is that, he's obviously not interested in finding that particular edge. What he's interested in is I suppose, something that I think about a lot, is trying to tap into the energy, to try and draw the energy of something, the dynamism, the dynamics of the thing, not necessarily how it simply appears, but also how it might be, how it exists, the way it might be sitting, or the way it might be leaning, or the way it might be balancing, or the way it might be precarious, or the way it might feel squashed. Or so there are other energies which are outside of the object, but also from within the object. And it's that pushing and pulling, the idea of nothing is contained really. So to try and define it as a shape is, I suppose, one goal. I'm not sure I'm very good at that, but the idea is that sometimes colors overspill their shapes. The idea that they might have a halo, they might have a kind of a beautiful resonance that they can't, that color isn't contained. If you look at someone like Ellsworth Kelly, there's a wonderful clarity of shape, but as soon as that color makes that shape, those boundaries are challenged. And I suppose, thinking about, and what I mean by trying to draw the way I'm seeing it, because it very much is about the position of where I am. So I will spend quite a lot of time trying to work out the viewpoint that I want to make this thing from. Sometimes it's settled very quickly. Sometimes it's sorted and it's settled, but sometimes the things move and are shifted around during the painting itself. Which can be frustrating and obviously technically is a bit of an issue. But the idea is it's very much about trying to understand where I'm seeing, but also how I'm seeing it. So it's not just a sort of cold, here, it's here, it's here, it's here. Some days it is. Some days you've really just got to go quite radically through and be systematic and just maybe try and sort things out because things have become awry or things aren't quite where you thought they were. And it is very things aren't where you thought they were, and also things aren't what you thought they might be or how they appear. You know, they challenge our perception and they become something completely new. So drawing for me is important in the way that I'm trying to draw the thing, but I'm also trying to draw within the painting, within its own construct, within its own framework. But drawing is very important because it reveals so much. But it also, you know, you have to make decisions about the drawing. And sometimes you have to take the drawing away and reduce it. So it becomes a reductive as well as an additive process or experience or approach, I suppose.
And I notice often a lot of the drawing lines will stay at the finished painting, the measurements and the ticks and stuff.
Yeah.
If I was to watch a time lapse, would, just to get a sense of how these are built, would it be, you know, they're getting covered and new ones placed and getting covered constantly and it's just growing, and the objects would probably like sort of shrink and expand the whole time if it was on a time lapse?
That's absolutely right. Physically, in terms of their place, but also, you know, certain things take over in paintings, don't they? You know, the idea that you can make one part of a painting, you can improve one part of a painting without actually touching it, because you actually work on another bit, and that bit resonates. So what's interesting is you know, it's almost like, I don't know, it's like creeping up on something via the back door. You know, there's an element of surprise. It's a bit like staring at something. You know, if you stare at it, it's going to evaporate. You know, you've almost got to find a sequence in order to see it. And I don't know what that sequence is. I mean, I'd sit there sometimes and say, well, if I look at that and look at that and look at that, I might understand what that is. But sometimes you stumble across something which you think, oh, that's made more sense of that because I've altered that. So, you know, the drawing can be quite radical, and it can be quite, you know, it's not finickety in that sense. It can be quite, you know, I would still, as a painting goes through a length of time, I would still be quite radical with maybe the shape making in terms of the size of the shape, you know, be quite happy to reduce it down to a bigger shape, even though I found out lots of information within that shape. But yeah, I mean, drawing is fundamentally the thing. And we all know, you know, people like Angra said that it was the probity of art, and the idea that painting was 7/8 drawing and all those things. And we, you know, that's absolutely right, because I suppose drawing brings it alive in many ways, but it's I suppose the dilemma is trying to make it work with the color. That's the dilemma. And so I try and make the color come from the drawing as much as I can, to generate the color and to then understand the form, the notion of the roundness of something, or the notion. But you know, sometimes you have to work across these things more and more and more, and a multiple number of times. It just doesn't happen in one. But yeah, no, it's a perplexing business, isn't it? I'm not sure that's answered your question in any shape or form.
I can't believe how well you've answered all these questions.
You know, Mark, I'm not sure we have this podcast to get a concrete answer. Yeah, like, this was an answer. What you said was perfect. I think the question was vague enough and the answer is perfect. But, tangents are what we do best. And that sounds kind of like the way your mind works too.
Yeah.
I can't remember, at some point when we first started this a few years ago, I found some iTunes review and whatever. And I was like, guys, just stick to the subject, you know, like really interview people instead of going off on all these tangents. I'm like, but that wouldn't be, that would be that's a different podcast. I have a question for you. If you could kind of go back, like, remembering you said when you were 25 and angry at the, you know, art is long and life is short thing. If you could talk to that person, yourself at 25, what would you tell them?
I'd probably hide what I was thinking at the time, probably, if I was able to do it retrospectively, warmly give them a hug and say, thank you very much, because you're absolutely right. But I was just perplexed at this thing, thinking, well, what does that mean? You know, what's going on here? I know that, but actually, I suppose as you become older, it starts to resonate, doesn't it? I suppose. But that's, you know, it was, but what was interesting about that exhibition, it was that Patrick George came along to have a look at it, and he wrote this most wonderful letter, this, you know, several sides. And, you know, I suppose I've been left the slate, I don't know, probably, could have been 8 years, could have been longer, I don't know. But the fact that he, you know, took the bother to come and then took the bother to write, it wasn't a pleasant letter, you know, it wasn't full of wonderful, lovely, complimentary things. It was actually about making points that maybe I should consider. And one of the big things he talked about was about the Venetians and about the idea of their colour being more about substance and less about colour. So the idea that colour is more about substance. And I think he talked about Constable in the same way in the letter. So when we look at Constable's colour, excuse me, or Titian, the idea that it was about substance and less about colour as a thing, but more about that contact with the thing. But no, it was a very encouraging letter by the fact that he was still trying to rattle my cage.
So I have one last question for you. Why did you choose Chardin to riff off of?
Well, he's just incredible, isn't he? I mean, that's, you know, I've been in love with his pictures ever since I saw them, you know, aged probably 15, 16. You know, look at the schoolmistress in the National Gallery, which I can't go to the National Gallery without going to it. You know, that's... There are some paintings you just have to go back to time and time and time again. Just the idea that what he's painting is just so beautifully articulate, but also incredibly invented, you know, in the way that he's playing with tensions of maybe something hanging over the edge of something, like a knife projecting on a table, or a house of cards with its fragility of balancing, or the idea of a projection of a piece of hair coming out from the side of someone's head and casting a shadow, which you don't see straight away. But this idea of projection, this idea of understanding that this lump is in front of this lump is in front of this lump, and the idea that although it's totally flat, I mean, they're just mesmerizing, aren't they, in every respect, in terms of their color, in terms of just the color is just so full of everything. It's just so full of energy. It's so full of light. It's so full of, I suppose we have to say, substance, you know, that idea that, and the way that the contours are made and the solidity of everything, the believability of everything. Yet when you look at it, it's just pieced together in this radical abstract way, but it makes in our minds and settles to such a degree that we could almost blow those cards over, you know, with a one puff, or we could touch the hair on the side of the schoolmistress's lacy cap. You know, they're just so incredible in the way that they are like that, that there's almost kind of, they almost become so much about space, they almost become vacuums, you know. Well, like the reverse of that, you know. But I suppose also the idea that he painted with love, didn't he? I think he was asked a question about what colours did he use. And he said, oh, well, I don't paint with colour, I paint with emotion. And I think it's that thing, that whole wonderful idea that they're so charged, aren't they? They're so charged about. And he painted the same things over and over and over again and tried to remake and re-say and finding new ways of trying to do the same thing. And I suppose it's just that idea that I was trying to think about a new sense of light. So within the painting, I did actually use a lamp because it was the only way I could get my studio to respond in the same way. But I mean, when I was a student, I made a transcription of Duccio's Annunciation, which is in the National Gallery. I started working from a photograph, a black and white photograph, which you could buy from the National then. It was wonderful because all the paintings were out of their frames and you could see right to the edges of the canvas, which was very exciting because you could understand the geometry of the whole thing. But I remember trying to make this painting from the black and white photograph. And of course, that wasn't going to work at all because I'm trying to remember the color of the thing. So what I did is I made a three-dimensional model of the painting from a single viewpoint using wood and cardboard and cloth. And so I made this, if you like, a still life from the painting, from a single viewpoint. So there's lots of clues within the painting, like where the center line is of the column that goes down the center of the painting. And then you could begin to work out the orthogonals, which obviously some are skewed because perspectivally the sort of single Albertian law wasn't used in many ways. There's a lovely other law being used, which I think works in a different way. But the idea as I slowly built this structure architecturally and then built the figures. And what was amazing was, you know, just trying to understand the color. And again, the colors for the setup weren't from, they weren't from a reproduction. So I would go to the National and then try and hold the color in my head. So the idea of looking at the back wall, which is the most beautiful kind of salmony pink orange, very subtle, very light color, and trying to use that to set the whole painting going. So using it as a key, if you like, then all the other colors would work in relation to that. So this thing became a still life. And so I've always been interested in not only painting things that are there, but also reconstructing things. So even, you know, the flowers or the fruit are also in structured environments that I've built. And there's something about building something, you know, and then painting it. There's something about trying to understand it. At the moment, I'm working from a three-dimensional sculpture that I've made from a lithograph by Robert Bevan, one of the Camden Town artists. And it's a painting of a location in Devon, and there's going to be an exhibition in March. But I didn't want to go to the place because I didn't see the point of going to the place where Bevan painted. So what I did, I recreated the place in black and white. So it's a monochrome sculpture from the monochrome lithograph. And I used the satellite image because all I had was one elevation, but the building still exists. So I used a satellite image to find the depth of the building. Which was wonderful because what was amazing, the sun was shining when the satellite image was, you know, on Google Earth, and it was projecting the end elevation, gable end of the building, which is so significant within the painting, onto the floor, onto the surface of the earth, which I was then able to really understand the dimensions of the gable end to the whole depth of the building. And so what's amazing is, although the building only takes up about a centimetre on the surface of the painting in terms of the side wall, the actual length of the building goes back about a metre in my scale model. So there's this wonderful kind of tension of understanding. So building things is also really important to me because it, and what's wonderful, obviously, is I had to make sure that I built it where everything was within the lithograph. So the positioning of things. So I had to find out where Bevan's eye level, where he stood and looked at this thing, so I could then work out where everything else was in relation. And of course, when you're building something three-dimensionally, you're having to adjust the size of something so that it appears the size it does on the drawing, on the flat plane. So to me, that got me going. So that's a painting I'm working on at the moment, trying to understand this bizarre idea that I'm trying to recreate the vision of Bevan from a three-dimensional model, which is where I've never been.
Wow, that is so cool. That's like so much intricate understanding of what you're about to do, models and satellite images. It's great. Well, Mark, this has been an absolute pleasure.
I'm finished. Is that it?
That's it.
Thank you. Oh my God. Thank you so much for talking. Marcia, thank you.
Thank you for listening, and I hope you got some good painting done while we entertained you with our amazing guest. If you like what you're hearing, follow and subscribe to our podcast if you haven't done so yet. And if you're so inclined, rate us whether you love or hate us. We love hearing all the different opinions and appreciate the feedback. You can reach out to us at artgrindpodcast@gmail.com or DM us on IG at artgrindpodcast. You faithful listeners have the power to help us grow. So please spread the word. It's free and you'll feel good about it. So until next time, stay on the grind while we fill your mind.